now that we have HopStop, MapQuest, and Google Maps, it only takes a few clicks to find out all kinds of geographical information, from how to get to Grandma's house to the precise location of every pizzeria in Tokyo. But there was a time when no one knew what the world looked like or that parts of it even existed. In his new book, The Fourth Part of the World, The Race to the Ends of the Earth, an epic story of the map that gave America its name, Atlantic Monthly contributing editor Toby Lester tells the fascinating story of European exploration leading up to the publication in 1507 of the Waldseemüller map, which gave the Americas their name. The book is published by Free Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Toby Lester to our show today. Hello.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Your book opens in the early 1200s, 300 years before the Waldseemüller map was even published. Why did you start three centuries earlier?
The 1200s in particular were a time when Europeans sort of awoke from a bit of a slumber and began expanding their horizons, and it seemed to me a natural way to introduce readers to the incredibly rich and complex geographical ideas that led up to the mapping of the world as we now know it.
Well, how much was known to Europeans at the time? I'm not talking about the Europeans who already were probably coming to the New World. It's claimed that the Basque did and the Vikings probably did. But were they? Did other Europeans even know that they were going there?
Well, it sort of depends who you're talking about, but basically the traditional teachings, which a lot of which dated back to the ancients, held that the world consisted of three parts: Europe, Asia, and Africa, and they gave primacy to Asia as the biggest of the continents, but also as the kind of source of the beginning of time and space. It's where the sun rose, it's where the Bible planted the Garden of Eden, it's where human history began, and those three parts of the world were shown a lot in a number of different ways on religious maps and scholarly diagrams, that kind of thing.
Your title seems to suggest that Europeans had an idea that there was a hidden part of the world, a fourth part.
Well, there are maps that date way back before Columbus and that era that suggest that Europeans were speculating about the existence of what they sometimes call the fourth part of the world. And even the Greeks and probably peoples before them imagined that there were lands out beyond the ocean. If you picture Europe, Asia, and Africa really is all just one contiguous landmass surrounded by water. That's what you often saw on maps, but then that was ringed by ocean, and it was almost natural to speculate that there might be something out there, almost inaccessible to people in the known world, but out there maybe even balancing the known world.
Although we learned in school that Columbus came upon America while he was seeking an alternate route to Asia, so he didn't expect to come upon a fourth part.
No, and in fact, it was pretty inconvenient for the early explorers because they had imagined that they would be taking a nice shortcut across the ocean to the Indies and Asia, and instead they bumped into this giant and apparently endless coastline that never resolved itself into the Asia that they knew from their maps.
Where did Columbus think he was headed on his first journey, and what did he think he found when he wound up, I guess, in the island of Hispaniola, where that's where Haiti and the Dominican Republic are now?
That's right. Well, if you look at maps of the time, you see a kind of hypothetical version of the Far East based pretty much on what Marco Polo and a few others had described when they had visited China centuries before. So Columbus had in mind that he was going to find his way to a number of the different places that Marco Polo had described, Japan, China, these places that were very rich in civilization and in material wealth, gold and spices and gems. And Columbus pictured that he would find a lot of islands, just as these maps showed, some big and some small, and then he'd find a mainland. And in fact, that's what he bumped into, a lot of islands of the Caribbean and then the mainland of South America. But he, proceeding basically logically, assumed that he had to have reached Asia, which of course is why he called the native inhabitants Indians.
Now, he didn't go to South America until his third voyage, because he was looking to find Asia, I assume. He landed on the northern coast of Venezuela.
That's right.
But didn't he also think that he discovered an earthly paradise?
Well, that's right. And that goes back to these kind of early Christian conceptions of the world. And a lot of maps and a lot of Christian geographers placed the Garden of Eden in the most distant reaches of Asia. It was the earthly paradise, after all. It had to be somewhere, and Adam and Eve had been planted on Earth. So it was almost natural to assume that you could find it somewhere at the distant most edge of Asia. And if you were approaching Asia from Europe, then that's what you would bump into first. And beyond that, a lot of medieval texts actually describe what this place looked like and what its surroundings were like. And when Columbus, on his third voyage, approached this part of Venezuela, there were a lot of factors there that seemed to him to correspond to these descriptions of the biblical earthly paradise.
Although we think of maps as guides, it seems that maps for a long time were not always intended to be all that accurate. Did Matthew Paris, the English monk and mapmaker, try to make his maps accurate?
It depends what you mean by accurate. In terms of geographical accuracy and the way we would define it now, no. But at the time, in the Middle Ages, a lot of maps often were called histories, and histories were sometimes, the text histories were sometimes called maps, and that those boundaries were not made in the way that we make them now. And when you look at an elaborate medieval map of the world, you see what appear to be all sorts of inaccuracies and a kind of jumble of ancient and biblical and mythological and contemporary places and place names and images. It seems like quite a jumble, but in fact what's going on is that these map makers are trying to lay out for you a kind of map to the evolution of human history, and especially Christian human history, played out against this kind of geographical backdrop.
It seems that around the year 1200, there was a lot of communication between Western Europe and a group called the Nestorians. Who were the Nestorians, and where did they live?
They were a sect of what you would call Eastern Christians who diverged fairly early on from the standard teachings and were banished from the church, and then began a spread farther and farther east. And by the 1200s, you find them not only in what today we'd call the Near East and the Middle East, but in fact way out into Central Asia and even in China. A lot of that part of Christianity for a long time was really the most numerous and widespread version of Christianity. It faded with the advent of Islam and other forces in that area, the Mongols as well. But to Christians in those times, the Nestorians were a very, very important group. And in fact, they preserved a lot of the ancient Greek texts that were then passed on to the Muslims. The Muslims employed the Nestorians in places like Baghdad as translators of the ancient Greek texts.
Weren't they responsible for stories about Prester John?
That's right, the mythical Christian king who was supposed to reside somewhere out in the east, and who had amassed a giant army and huge amounts of wealth, and was poised, so the story went, to approach Jerusalem from the east and help Western European Christians reconquer Jerusalem at the time of the Crusades. He was a figure. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy in the literature. He's described as just always imminent and yet never quite making his way to where Europeans want to find him. And initially he resides in Asia, but then he kind of migrates to Africa, and the search for Prester John and his great armies and his great wealth was one of the main engines that fueled the European exploration of Africa.
So they were not just looking for riches and pagans to convert to Christianity?
Right. I mean, the idea was that if they could find him, they would not only tap into his wealth, but it would bring the two long-parted branches of Christianity together, and that would create a kind of pincer effect that would help defeat the Muslim territories and bring Jerusalem back under unified control of a by then, the Europeans imagined European global Christian empire.
Didn't some people think the Mongol invaders in the 13th century were Christians?
That's right, and there are great sort of fuzzy stories early on in the 1100s and 1200s of that are clearly sort of third-hand, fourth-hand reports that probably traveled through the Nestorians in the Far East all the way to Jerusalem and then on to Western Europe that record what seemed to have been battles between Mongols who were attacking first Muslim lands and then European pagan and Christian lands, and they interpret the Mongols and then especially Genghis Khan even as the advent of Prester John. The Mongols at some points, especially when they were attacking Christian lands, would dupe the Christians by carrying a cross in front of them, and the Christians who were sort of primed to expect Prester John, who also had carried a cross in front of him as he marched with his armies, submitted to these cross-bearing Mongol advances and were destroyed.
In the later part of the 19th century, Marco Polo made his voyages with protection from Kublai Khan, the Mongol ruler. How did he get the protection of this much-feared Khan?
Well, he and his uncle and father traveled out to China, not knowing the Mongols, of course, but they established contact in circumstances that are impossible to reconstruct. But they traveled to Central Asia, where the Mongols held sway, and then made their way across Central Asia and into China, and ended up in Mongol-occupied China, where Kublai Khan ruled. And Marco, it seems, was at that point a very gifted young man who spoke a lot of languages and who ingratiated himself with the court somehow, and in fact was then sent out by the Khan to survey and explore Mongol territories and bring information back to the Khan.
Toby Lester is my guest. He's a contributing editor to and has written extensively for The Atlantic. You may have heard him featured on the radio show This American Life as well. His book, The Fourth Part of the World, The Race to the Ends of the Earth and the Epic Story of the Map That Gave America Its Name, is published by Free Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Toby Lester, whose book, The Fourth Part of the World, The Race to the Ends of the Earth and the Epic Story of the Map That Gave America Its Name, is published by Free Press. Toby, today we have satellites to measure the distance between points on the globe. How did the ancient Greeks determine distance? And didn't that suggest that they didn't believe the Earth was flat?
It's very obvious that way back into antiquity, people knew that the world was round. One of the examples that comes up again and again in text is that to prove this is that sailors can always see the horizon, see ships coming up over the horizon and see land approaching. And if you're on the mast of a ship, you can see land before you can see it when you're on the deck of a ship. So it was in the air from way, way back that the Earth was round. And in fact, the model of the cosmos that the ancients used described everything as spherical. The Earth was a sphere at the center, and then the stars and the planets were around the Earth, all revolving themselves in spherical motion. And that's how Claudius Ptolemy, in particular, the great second century Greek astronomer and geographer, began to figure out how places on the world could be mapped. You looked at the pole star in particular and figured out where it was in the sky, and that allowed you to determine your latitude. And then you measured distances and did also some other observations of stars and planets, and you figured out your longitude, and then you crossed those two lines. That was something that the ancient Greeks seemed to have done, and Ptolemy put into writing in a book called the Geography in the second century.
So he kind of invented latitude and longitude?
Well, I wouldn't say that he invented it, because it seems as though he was relying on what some of his predecessors had done. But he's the one who really literally wrote the book, and not only that, collected about 8,000 points of latitude and longitude, effectively digitizing a picture of the ancient world. He may or may not have drawn maps with his book, but it didn't matter because when Europeans in the early Renaissance rediscovered his book after about 1,000 years of its not having been known, they had all these data points, and they could, you know, plot the dots, connect the lines, color everything in, and they'd have an almost magical reconstruction of the ancient world.
So they, if they were following his ideas, they would have known the Earth was a lot bigger than Columbus was suggesting.
Right, although Ptolemy didn't have perfect information either, and he overestimated the extent, the longitudinal extent of Europe and Asia. So Ptolemy's version of the known world made from Spain all the way out to part of China about half the globe. And then Marco Polo, when he traveled beyond the limits of Ptolemy's East, made China seemed to extend a good deal farther around the globe than just half the world. So it wasn't too unreasonable for Columbus to imagine that the expanse of ocean between the coasts of Spain and Portugal and China and Japan was relatively small.
You write that Portuguese geographers may have had good scientific reasons to reject Columbus's plan, and that King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain rejected Columbus on numerous occasions.
Right. The sort of standard story, which is basically propagated by Washington Irving in the 19th century, who was the one who played up this idea that Columbus knew the world was round, but everybody else thought it was flat, and they were, you know, sort of laughed him out of the room when they themselves were utterly ignorant of what the world really looked like. As it happens, Columbus had a rather optimistic idea of how much ocean lay between Europe and Asia, and the advisors to the courts in Spain and Portugal knew that the world was actually much, much bigger than Columbus was arguing it was, and therefore they were right to reject his plan, because had the New World not been in the way, there's really no way he could have sailed on the ships that he had given and working with the information that he had all the way from Europe across the Pacific to Asia. Just wouldn't have been possible.
So where does Amerigo Vespucci come into this story? Why his name?
Vespucci was a merchant, and there were a lot of merchants at the end of the 15th century drifting over to Spain and Portugal because it was an age of great maritime expansion. The Portuguese were rapidly making their way down the coastline of Africa and around Africa eventually and into the Indian Ocean toward the Spice Islands in India. And the Spanish and Portuguese also, in the final decade, made their way to the New World. So there was lots of economic opportunity, and Vespucci seems to have first arrived in Spain and Portugal just as a merchant. In fact, he helped outfit Columbus's second voyage as a sort of supplier. But he seems to have gotten the bug, and he hitched a ride on some voyages. It's not exactly clear how many across the Atlantic at the end of the 1400s and beginning of the 1500s. But unlike Columbus, who restricted himself pretty much to the Caribbean region and the very northern parts of South America, Vespucci made one spectacularly long voyage down the coast of South America, thousands of miles, as he put it. And it was really that southness of the New World that made the biggest impression in the early days of discovery on Europeans. They knew, because they knew the world was round, that if you sailed far enough across the Atlantic, you would hit Asia, and that's what Columbus was telling everybody that he'd done. But Vespucci wrote letters home saying that he had not only sailed across the Atlantic like Columbus had, but he'd sailed literally off every known map in the south and had found land in places where no geographer had expected there to be land.
So is that what inspired Martin Baltasimuller and Matthias Ringmann to come up with a new kind of map?
That's right. Vespucci believed he was exploring part of Asia. It wasn't that he announced he had discovered a new part of the world, but when he wrote letters home describing what he'd found, those letters were printed by printers in Florence first and then in other towns in Europe, and those letters made their way to a little town in the mountains of eastern France called Saint-Dié, where Martin Waldseemüller and some other scholars were at work already on a world atlas. And they, for reasons that aren't entirely clear to us today, decided that what Vespucci had discovered and Columbus had discovered was not some still-to-be-figured-out part of Asia, but actually was an entirely new fourth part of the world, in addition to the three parts already known, Europe, Asia, and Africa.
And I'm assuming since this was the new place to go, that map would be in high demand.
Yeah, I mean, they clearly thought it was big news because they decided to make their map giant. It was 8 feet by 4.5 feet or so. It was actually 12 separate sheets, each printed on a separate wood block that could then be assembled and made into a giant wall map or bound into a book and paged through like a giant atlas.
Did it make them rich?
We have no way of knowing that. They supposedly printed 1,000 copies. Only one has survived, and that's the copy that was bought in 2003 by the Library of Congress for $10 million.
Now, how we have a copy of it on our website. In fact, we have a slideshow of maps and illustrations from your book on our show page. But how trustworthy was this map? They were drawing from a combination of ancient and contemporary sources, weren't they?
They were, and that's really what drew me to the map, and that's what I love about the map. It's not the kind of geography that you would expect from a world map today. It looks fairly similar to the world that we know now, and in a lot of ways, it really is the kind of mother of modern maps.
Would we recognize anything looking at it? Would we say, "Oh, gee, there's Brazil"?
You'd recognize most things, although they're, especially at the margins, they're distorted in part because of the lack of information, in part because it's a different projection than we use now. But it really is the very first map to depict the world as a whole, largely as we know it today. And because of that alone, it's probably worth the price that the Library of Congress paid for it. But it's, as you said, it's really kind of a patchwork. At its core, the central part of the map is based on Ptolemy, an ancient vision of the world that includes ancient place names. In the Far East, they've stitched on this kind of hypothetical vision of the Far East that was based on Marco Polo. They've also borrowed for the southern coastlines of Africa and the New World from the charts that were made by sailors who were exploring these places. And then they brought them all together and overlaid it with this idea that that had been current for centuries, that there might be a fourth part of the world out there. And it comes together to create this kind of it's a sort of kaleidoscopic vision of the world that includes not just geography but history. And I like to think of it as a great window for looking back into history, in the way that medieval map makers used to want their maps to be histories, not just geographies.
And a certain amount of conjecture. They drew both North and South America surrounded by water. Balboa was the first European to see the Pacific Ocean in 1513. That's 6 years after the map was published.
That's right, and that's one of the great mysteries of the map. It's one of the things that draws a lot of people to it, to study it. Supposedly, they shouldn't have known this. And so people speculate. Some people think that maybe it incorporates knowledge of secret Portuguese voyages that were made around the southern tip of the continent. Other people think maybe it reflects knowledge gathered by the Chinese on their various explorations of the world, although that tends to be so speculative that I didn't bother even including that in my book. My guess, after having gone all over the map literally on this question, is that it wasn't either of these. It was just that Waldseemüller and his colleagues had a pretty good idea of the size of the world. They had a lot of data about this new place that seemed to be emerging, almost in the way that a face emerges when you rub a coin. And when they put together the size of the world and the fact that this coastline didn't correspond to Asia and seemed to be a long way from where Asia probably ended, it almost by definition it had to be something new.
Although it is amazing that anybody could work things out, because people like Vespucci were inventing stories. He made extraordinary claims about cannibals and sexually lascivious women. did people believe his claims?
Sure. And I mean, a lot of what he was writing about incorporated truths, and then when his letters got into the hands of printers, it may be that the printers decided that what Vespucci had originally written wasn't quite saucy enough, so they themselves sprinkled some Saxon cannibalism and adventure on the high seas in there as well. There were a lot of medieval travel accounts that were sort of the equivalent of tabloid accounts, you know, when you have pictures in the tabloids of all these strange two-headed babies and monsters and half human, half animal kinds of creatures. All that stuff was a staple of medieval geographical literature as well.
Before Rupert Murdoch started publishing these things. At the end of your book, we have just a minute or so left, you suggest that Nicholas Copernicus saw something in the Waldseemüller map that prompted him to theorize that the Earth revolved around the sun rather than the other way around.
That's right. This is not to say that the map was the thing that made him smack his forehead and realize that the model of the universe had to change, but it does seem from references he makes in his own work that he, in looking at the Waldseemüller map, was able to deduce that the standard model for the universe, which involved the Earth as a sphere at the center of all creation, but then the known world kind of emerging out of one side of the sphere of water, this map made him feel that that model couldn't hold because it had the new world emerging out of the other side of the sphere of water, directly opposite the known world, where there shouldn't have been any land. It's a bit convoluted, but it's a fun way to think about this map actually having an influence that's not just geographical, but also literally cosmic.
How soon before we see more accurate maps?
More accurate maps of the world.
Of the new world.
Well, you know, there are a lot of charts that come back that sort of gradually depict more and more accurately the various coastlines that are being explored in the new world. And in the course of the 16th century, you get all of that information incorporated on academic geographical maps of the world. But there are lots of sort of steps backward at the same time that there are steps forward. It's quite a while before you get a kind of stable picture of the planet as we know it now.
We have provided a slideshow of maps and illustrations from your book, The Four Parts of the World, on our show page at WNYC.org. Must have been a lot of fun researching this book and looking at all those maps and wondering, how did they come up with that?
Oh, it's great. And the world of maps is one that I think tugs at just about everybody. And the earlier the map, the more imaginative and creative they have to be, and the more you get a kind of picture of people groping their way almost blindly but imaginatively toward a picture of where we are in the universe. And I just found that a lot of fun.
Toby Lester's The Fourth Part of the World, The Race to the Ends of the Earth, an epic story of the map that gave America its name, is published by Free Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
No, thanks for having me.